10. The truth is, Helen hates coming home for the holidays. She feels a lot of guilt about it, and that doesn't help. There's a memorial for Michelle set up in her former bedroom turned study, and it's always Helen's first stop during a visit home. She has no idea when in that first year her parents decided to change Michelle's bedroom. And Helen still remembers the whiplash of coming home for summer break and seeing that long shut door suddenly opened to a room she had never seen before. Why didn't they ask before changing it? She'd been pissed on Michelle's behalf. I should have protected you from that. The walls are lined with clean white IKEA bookshelves. The first shelf to the left is full of textbooks on organic chemistry and Chinese test prep books from the 80s. Relics of her parents' graduate studies. A large section, two bookshelves full, is devoted to Helen's own novels, each row boasting at least a dozen copies of each book in the Ivy Papers series, along with various translations and special book club editions. Below the one window in the room, a shorter shelf holds the small collection of books Helen and Michelle shared between them. A combination of science fiction classics that Dad would read to them as children and their own carefully considered Scholastic Book Fair purchases. And on top of that short shelf rests a neat row of silver-framed photos, deceased grandparents and Michelle. Helen lights two sticks of incense and bows. Then she places the slow-burning incense in the waiting pot next to Michelle's portrait. The heady scent always paints a memory in the smoke of the first time she did this ritual with Michelle when they were visiting China at ages 12 and 10. They were in the countryside with distant relatives and paying their respects to long-dead people they'd never met at a fireplace memorial in an otherwise bustling kitchen. Helen recalls affecting a serious expression and acting as if she knew what she was doing, and Michelle carefully copying her movements as their elderly relatives clucked approvingly in the background. If you were here, we'd be at a bar catching up. The thing Helen struggles to imagine most is her sister today, if things had been normal. It's as though her brain stumbles, suddenly flummoxed every time. This is the end. You are leaving the city limits of imaginable things. Michelle would have been anticipating turning 30 next year, but what would that have looked like? Would she be single or possibly married? Would she have a pet? What city would she live in? What would her apartment look like? Helen can't picture any of it. Every conjecture feels half-hearted and paper-thin, less real than all the fictional characters she's created. The real Michelle didn't want to be here. Helen sits in an armchair by the window and picks out a book, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. She keeps reading from where she left off her last trip home. Sometimes she'll find a dog-eared page or an underlined passage telling her where Michelle once left off, too. Helen has read through their entire shared collection twice, just in case she missed something. The other homecoming routines will be mundane from here. Mom always scrubs the floors down to their varnish in anticipation of a visit and has a meal of all of Helen's favorite home-cooked dishes ready to greet her, no matter what time she arrives. Dad is more gruff. They usually run out of conversation by her second day home.
How's work? I saw this article about another Chinese author.
But grunts approvingly whenever Helen updates them about life and work. She shares only the good things. A book announcement, a positive review, news about the show's development, a writing retreat with friends. She hates the look of worry in their eyes. It reminds her too much of a childhood stifled by parental concern and gives her a woolly, claustrophobic feeling that makes her want to run and run and run until the pavement turns into the California beach beneath her feet. Helen has never introduced them to any of the men she's dated over the years. The thought of having to tell them about a breakup is so impossible a concept, it's laughable. The white friends in her author groups would balk at this, while her Asian friends would often nod and commiserate.
But never? Like not even one?
Elise had exclaimed with wide eyes.
They can meet when there's a ring on her finger, Pallavi had said, waving it off. Otherwise, what's the point?
Elise would say, the point is so that your parents know what's going on in your life. But Helen has created a very special window into her life that's just for her parents.
Don't look there. The view's not as good, she would say,
pulling the drapes over a messy fourth date, a failed situationship, a bad breakup, and a drunken night out. She stores up bad news like acorns in the winter and meets them out in small doses when she finally has good news to soften the blow.
The revision's been tough, but I finally turned it in and my editor loved it. I hadn't heard from Elise in a while and thought she was mad at me, but it turns out she's expecting her first child and she wanted to surprise everyone.
You feel a lot of responsibility for other people's feelings, her therapist once told her, as she described the careful little ways she frames her life for her parents.
She supposes that's true. Her mother's knuckles still turn white from gripping the steering wheel whenever they drive down that one stretch of Route 22 on the way to the mall.
Helen once boldly asked why they didn't just move somewhere else, somewhere they weren't as burdened by the knowledge that there should be two Jung sisters moving through the world.
What's the point? Mom had said. We know this place, and we're too old to start new somewhere else and have to learn everything again. Besides, your sister is here.
Helen knows she doesn't mean Michelle's ghost. Her mother is unfailingly turned off by any kind of superstition. She means Michelle's body is here, in a cemetery over the hill on the other side of the mountain that carves out the boundary of Dunnelly, New Jersey, from its neighboring townships.
Helen looks around the study, trying to feel Michelle's ghost here.
Nothing. On her third day home, the day before Christmas Eve, Helen tells Mom to take the night off from cooking. She drives to Reimer's Pizzeria and orders two large pepperoni pizzas and a bundle of garlic knots from the pimply-faced teenager behind the counter. A few moments later, her first kiss, Ian Reimer, appears from the kitchen, his eyes crinkled in their perpetual smile, his arms stretched out for a hug that she submits to happily.
It's my famous author friend, Ian says. I heard you moved to LA and you're a Hollywood big shot now.
Helen snorts. You sound like a cartoon right now, she says. Hollywood big shot, fuck off. Ian grins and pulls out a chair to sit down with her.
I feel like it's been ages. What's going on in your life?
My life is the same as always, she says. Writing, hating my writing, revising, convincing myself I'm a genius, then doing it all over again. Tell me about your life.
Ian shakes his head. Nuh-uh. You don't get off that easy. You moved across the country where they don't even have good pizza. How are you doing?
Honestly, the farther away I am from my parents, the happier I am. She says this glibly, the kind of joking thing they would have said to each other as teenagers. But does she actually mean it?
So you like it out there?
Helen thinks of her condo in Santa Monica, of the podcasts she listens to on her long commutes in the morning, of the bright blue sky and the palm trees, and the sound of trucks unloading on the studio lot as she walks into the writer's room.
I do, she says.
That's great, Helen, Ian says. It's nice to see you happy.
Helen smiles, then nudges him.
What about you? You're a family man now.
He grins and whips out his phone to show her pictures.
Deanna's hoping to go for a second kid next year, he says. But look at this little fluff ball. He had so much hair when he was born, Dee almost cried laughing.
As Helen carries the pizzas and garlic knots to her car, she thinks about how much fatherhood makes sense on Ian Reimer. He's not the skinny kid cutting track practice to kiss her in the library anymore.
He looks more solid and dependable now. Like he's grown up, she thinks, and feels the ache of something bittersweet stretch up.
Hey!
A familiar voice calls out when she reaches the parking lot. She turns to see Grant standing across the lot next to an unfamiliar gray CRV. He clicks the keys to lock the doors with a chirp. Hi, she says, placing the pizzas on the hood of her car. Fancy seeing you here. He looks a little amused at her old-fashioned turn of phrase, and she kind of wants to disappear into the woods.
What'd you get?
Pepperoni and garlic knots, she says.
I never got the garlic knots here before,
he says. You should try them. Grant looks up at the sky. It's a thick kind of light gray.
Think it's gonna snow later, he says.
She cranes her neck and looks up, too. I think it's already snowing on the other side of the mountain.
Better get my pizza order in soon, then,
he says. I better get home before they get cold, she says. He nods and heads toward the pizzeria. He pauses at the sidewalk outside and turns to wave at her.
It's good to see you, he says.
You too, she says, and gets into her car.
Would have been nice to find out you were in town sooner. Grant stares at the text from Lauren on his phone, the one he hasn't responded to yet. He's been busy, and he knows she would understand if he told her. He's been shuttling his mother from their home to his uncle's house in the next township every day, spending hours at a time in Fred Shepherd's basement sorting boxes of old family photos, saved receipts, and letters, a lifetime of paper. It's emotional work for his mom, and Grant wishes sometimes they could dump all the boxes in the street with the rest of the trash after Christmas and be done with it. Instead, Lisa Shepherd insists on seeing each picture, clucking and cooing over it, explaining to him who each acquaintance featured in the background might be, she thinks, and sighing. It's just such an awful reminder that this is where it all ends up, she says, looking around the damp basement. Where we all end up. And then your family ends up going through your boxes, deciding what to keep and what to throw away. It's not even his mom's brother. Fred was Grant's dad's brother. But Lisa grew up next door to both of them, and as Fred never married, they folded him into their family as a bonus member on family vacations, birthdays, and celebrations. He needs to socialize more, Grant always heard his parents whispering to each other. Grant is pretty sure Uncle Fred had resented their concern, and he's wondered more than once if there were an alternate universe where Lisa had married Fred instead of his brother, if it would have worked out better that way for everyone involved. Instead of in a marriage that fell apart, or maybe just stopped keeping up appearances as soon as Grant went off to college. Would have been nice to find out you were in town sooner. The truth is, Grant hasn't wanted to see Lauren during this trip home. It's been over a year since he last saw her. She was on vacation in Aruba when he was here in the summer, and part of him thinks, aren't we getting too old for this? He never intended for this to keep going for as long as it did. It started as a way to pass the hours back home when he was in college, and somehow, over a decade later, it occurs to Grant that this might qualify as his longest relationship. He always assumed one of them would find a reason to break it off. He'd start dating someone seriously, or she would get engaged and he'd see it on Facebook. Instead, she's become as familiar a landmark in Denali to him as Washington Rock. The viewpoint at the top of the mountain where George Washington supposedly observed the British troops once, possibly. His sense of decency won't let the text, slightly accusatory in tone, go unanswered, and a few hours later he's leaving the house to meet Lauren at the one bar in Denali that's open after 10 p.m. You look different, she says, her eyes raking from his hair to his chest as they sit across from each other in a booth. She looks the same. Her dark hair pulled back in a clean ponytail. She's wearing leggings and a warm, oversized sweater. You look good, he says, searching for something to say. I saw you ran a marathon in April. She smiles. All the girls in the office signed up, she says. She works in a dentist's office in the nicer part of Denali, and she's been there since graduation, he's pretty sure. I got the best time, though. He nods, and the waiter comes by for their drink orders. Hers is the same as always, an amaretto sour with two cherries, something so sweet and sugary the taste would linger when he kissed her. He doesn't really want a drink now. He thinks about ordering a beer so she doesn't feel self-conscious about her own drink, but finally orders a decaf coffee instead. Lauren raises a brow.
You're not drinking?
I have to get up early tomorrow, he says. There's guys from the storage facility coming for Uncle Fred's stuff. Lauren nods. She tilts her head as she looks at him.
Are you seeing anyone these days?
Grant shakes his head and makes a small sound of dissent. You? Lauren shrugs.
No one permanent, she says.
He's comfortable around Lauren, he realizes. His body is relaxed in a way it hasn't been in weeks. He wonders if this feeling is love. Then, randomly, thinks of the way Ian Reimer had shown him pictures of his family when he stopped by the pizzeria earlier this afternoon. He gets an itchy feeling as he remembers seeing Helen in the parking lot and their conversation about Lauren at the wine bar in LAX. Do you ever wish? He starts, then thinks better of it, then decides to ask anyway. Do you ever wish you could find someone more permanent? Lauren laughs.
Why? Are you trying to set me up?
Grant shrugs. What are you looking for? Maybe I know someone. She quirks a knowing brow at him, and it would be easy, so easy, to take this conversation down a familiar, flirtatious path. My mom's selling her house, he says instead, changing the subject. It goes on the market in January.
I'm not in a position to buy, Lauren says, frowning.
Yeah, no, I was just sharing, he says. She wants to move to Ireland once it's done.
Ireland?
Lauren says, brows lifting. Apparently, she always wanted to live there at some point in her life, but it was never the right time.
Oh.
Lauren studies him for a moment, then.
Why do you think we never fell in love?
Grant finds he isn't surprised by the question. I don't know, he says. I don't want you to think I don't care about you. I do. She smiles at him a little sadly.
I know you do, she says. I don't mean with each other. We were never meant to last past high school. I mean, why do you think we never fell in love with other people?
Grant wants to conduct a thorough investigation of this question. He wants to tape it off and walk its perimeter while he examines it from every angle. But he knows, before he can even untangle the thought, there's probably something wrong with me. I don't know, he says finally. Maybe it's just not in the cards for us.
I'd like it to be, she says. It seems like it'd be nice.
He remembers suddenly the first blush of their own romance. That weekend in a rented beach house after prom, he had broken up with his girlfriend, Desiree, because he knew he was going to college far away and he didn't want to draw it out. But he'd taken her to prom first because he felt like he owed it to her.
You're such an idiot,
she had said after he'd tried to gently end things in the car on the way to Seaside Heights. She'd made him pull over at a rest stop so one of her friends could pick her up and drive her to the same beach house instead. Lauren had been someone else's date that weekend. He doesn't even remember whose. She wasn't part of their usual crew. She ran more with the stoners and future art majors. But as the end of high school drew nearer, those clearly defined lines separating their friend group seemed to blur, and he remembers drinks in a hot tub, a game of truth or dare, and a first kiss with damp, clinging hair and searching mouths. She was the first person he'd called after the accident a week later. She stroked his hair while he cried in her lap. He'd been embarrassed to ask so much of someone he barely knew, but Lauren hadn't seemed to mind. It had connected them in a strange way.
Do you want to get married?
She asks, then adds,
I'm not proposing, just wondering, generally.
Grant laughs and thinks of what he told Helen back at the airport. I'd like to be married someday. He meant it, and he thinks maybe that's why he's telling Lauren about his mom selling the house. Lauren is a dangling thread that keeps him tied to this place, and it doesn't seem very fair to any of them. I do, he says out loud. Someday. I should probably do something about that. Lauren smiles as she tilts her head. The action is so familiar, his heart kind of aches for it.
I hope you do, she says. When they walk out of the bar, Lauren lingers as she searches for her keys. Are you good to drive? Grant asks. I'll be fine, she says. The drinks get weaker here every year. She considers him. Are you heading home? There's an invitation in that question somewhere. One last time, maybe? I am, he says. Get home safe.
You too, she says.
She reaches out and touches his cheek softly, brushing a thumb against his stubble. He catches her hand suddenly and presses a kiss to the back of it. She laughs, surprised.
Well, that's the most romantic thing you've ever done, Lauren says. Merry Christmas, Grant.
It starts snowing as she says it, and he feels like they're living out the end of someone else's rom-com. Maybe every movie ending has extras in the background just trudging through toward the rest of their lives. Merry Christmas, he says back to her. She opens her car door, then pauses.
You deserve to be happy. I hope you know that.
Lauren smiles, and Grant feels a complicated knot in his stomach tug as he tries to return it. After she gets in her car and drives off, he stays standing there, fat snowflakes floating down from the sky and dusting his hair, his shoulders, and the ground beneath his feet. He pulls out his phone and numbly swipes until he finds the name he's looking for. He presses dial before he can talk himself out of it, and he realizes he's holding his breath because it releases as soon as he hears the voice on the other end.
Hello?
Helen says, her voice low and quiet. Do you want to get lunch tomorrow? He asks, as if this is normal for them, as if he calls all the time. I have to finish clearing out my uncle's house in the morning, but I'm free afterward, and I think I might lose my mind if I spend another day at home alone. There's a pause, then the click of a door shutting in the background. Helen sounds closer to the phone when she speaks again.
Send me the address, she says.
11. She tells her parents she's going to meet up with a friend and drives to a bagel place in the next township over. Helen makes a mental note to bring back a half dozen bagels and prepares a story of breakfast sandwiches shared with an old friend from the ampersand who's unexpectedly in town. It feels almost like espionage if the stakes were toasted cinnamon raisin bagels. She feels a fluttery kind of nervousness when she walks through the door and sees him standing in line, their rendezvous point. I haven't been here in forever, she says, trying not to sound like she's read too many spy novels. We used to get giant bags of bagels here to sell at our morning fundraisers for the school newspaper. I remember, he says. They order breakfast sandwiches to go and drive to Washington Rock to eat them. There's a short, pitiful excuse for a nature walk trail by the far end of the parking lot, and he suggests they take it. It's a gray, gloomy Christmas Eve, and it seems unlikely they'll see anyone else there. There are patches of snow on the ground from last night, though not enough to hide the muddy, leaf-covered path. My mom's selling her house, he says. I met her real estate agent this morning. Oh, says Helen. You guys have been in that house a long time. She remembers passing Grant's house on their daily school bus route, back before any of them had cars. It was a beautiful Victorian near the top of the mountain, with perfectly lined up windows that captured spectacular light at sunrise and sunset, and she used to look forward to the part of the morning when she would see it approaching on the horizon. I'm surprised she stayed as long as she did, he says. She's talking about moving to Ireland and working on a sheep farm. I think she might actually do it. Helen tries to remember Mrs. Shepherd, who she met only a handful of times at parent-teacher fundraising events. She remembers a tiny blonde woman in a pink cardigan with gold jewelry. Your dad lives in Boston now? She asks. For the last 12 years, he says. Pretty much since they separated. Do you ever visit him? Grant shrugs. He prefers to come visit me. He likes the sunshine and the beaches. Helen nods. What about your parents?
How are they?
She kicks a pebble in the path. They're good. Dad's taken up golfing, and Mom's waging a war with some squirrels in her garden. I don't think they'll ever move. Grant nods and tosses the wrappings of his bagel into a nearby trash can. They've already reached the end of the trail.
Short walk, he says, looking around.
I don't think I've ever gone on it, Helen says.
Me neither. What do you usually do when you're in town?
Pretty much nothing, Helen laughs. Sulk in my bedroom and regress into my teenage self, mostly. It's like time doesn't pass in our house. They turn and walk back toward the parking lot. Helen can't help but feel like this has been a dud of a meetup, and wouldn't blame him if they parted ways and didn't speak again until they're safely back in L.A. When they reach their cars, Grant turns to her and asks,
Do you want to go see the high school?
Sure, Helen says. You drive.
He didn't really expect her to say yes when he asked, let alone volunteer to carpool with him. She hops in the passenger seat, and the sound of 106.7 Light FM's Christmas Classics comes on the radio. She smiles at that. My parents always have that station on in their car, too, she says. He drives them down the back of the mountain, past the houses that used to be as familiar to him as the faces of his friends and teachers. Some of them have changed in the years since he left. Fresh coat of paint here, a new addition to the wraparound porch there, and he always experiences a slight shock of unwanted surprise to discover his old small town keeps changing and moving on without him, too. He parks them in the upper parking lot behind the north side of the campus. It's where he used to park every day on his way to morning football practice. Wow, she says. I haven't seen it in so long. They added another wing, he says. He hasn't turned the keys out of the ignition yet. He's reluctant to burst their bubble of warmth in the car. Do you think we can get inside? She asks. Grant pops open the door. Let's find out, he says. The first door they try is locked, and so is the second. He's about to suggest they just walk around the open track when he remembers the side door by the teacher's lounge hallway where his friends used to sneak back in after cutting class. The lock's broken on that one. All it needs is one good yank. The door gives way, and with one metallic clank, they're staring into the empty hallways of their old high school. It's so, Helen says as she steps inside. He follows her and shuts the door behind them. Empty? Where do you want to go? He asks, tucking his hands in his pockets. He feels nervous suddenly, like they might get in trouble, like she might think this is just as lame as the nature walk at Washington Rock, like she might think he's a loser for even suggesting this. I wonder if the cafeteria's changed, she says, and leads the way down the hall. They find the old cafeteria quickly. The floors look like they've gotten an update, but everything else? The tables and chairs, the walls, the windows, the inexplicable scent of graham cracker that permeates the air no matter how many greasy pizzas were eaten here, is all the same. They took out the vending machines, Helen says as they wander inside. We used to have a coffee cart over there. I don't think they're allowed to serve coffee to minors anymore, Grant muses. I used to put 3 packets of sugar in my iced coffee, Helen says, looking around with slight amazement. They keep walking the perimeter until Helen stops at a table near the window. I used to sit here at lunch. Do you remember where you used to sit? Grant turns and points at the opposite corner. Over there. Helen nods, staring at his old table as if she can see their past lunching selves. He sits down on her table, his legs swinging off the edge. Nice view from this table. I liked having a window so close, she says. Colder in the winter, though, he notes. She shrugs. I usually wasn't here this late in December. Where do you want to see next? He votes for their junior year English classroom, but the door is locked, and they can only peer through the window in the door. I don't recognize any of these teachers' names, Helen says as they walk down the English wing. I guess all of our teachers retired. Did you keep in touch with any of them? No, I should have, she says. I heard my favorite teacher, Mr. Choi, the faculty rep for the Ampersand. He died a few years back, right before I published my first book.
I'm sorry, he says, and means it. She tries a door at random, and it opens. It's a closet room full of old, dusty books. School edition hardcovers of classics like Great Expectations and Shakespeare's Tragedies, and Norton's anthology compendiums of the American literary canon. There are piles of books so high they tower over Helen. Jackpot, she whispers and walks in. She opens one book and laughs, then tosses it at him. First page. He opens it and sees the register of the names of students who once held this particular copy of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, sandwiched between students from the classes of 07 and 09, is Lauren DeSantos in a cramped cursive scrawl. He laughs and thinks about taking a picture to send to Lauren. But would that be weird? I don't even remember which ones we read which year, he says instead, setting the book down. We did Shakespeare senior year, she says, picking through the books. Austin and Bronte sophomore year, and I don't remember the rest. I want to see if I can find my Wuthering Heights. If I do, I'm taking it. He opens a copy of Wuthering Heights, scanning for familiar names. A few names tickle the back of his memory, but nothing solid. He opens another, and a name stares back at him in bold Sharpie. Here, he says thickly, tapping it. You found it? She moves over, then stops when she sees the name he's pointing at. Michelle Zhang, 10. Oh. You want it? He asks, trying to keep his voice low and neutral. Helen touches her sister's name. No, she says finally. It's better off here, living its life, educating high school students. She laughs ruefully. That probably sounds insane. No, he says. That makes perfect sense. She smiles at him in gratitude, and he swallows hard. What now? Where did you spend the most time when we were here? She asks. He thinks, then jerks his head outside. Football practice, but it's pretty cold. I guess when it was winter, we'd do some drills in the North Gym. Okay, she says, and he leads the way.
Walking through the empty halls of their old public high school feels like walking into a memory. She trails her fingertips along the solid walls to reassure herself they're real. There's a strange, dreamlike quality to the day, and if she could, she'd reach out her fingers and touch Grant to check if he was real, too. That was my favorite mirror, she says, pointing at a mirror on one of the hallway intersections on their way to the gym. I always checked my hair and clothes in it on the way to class. The first door to the gym is locked, too, but as Grant tries the other door, Helen spots something that makes her shout in delight. Look at you, she exclaims, and points up at a dusty framed photo on the wall by the trophy case. Denali Warriors Varsity Football Team, 2007 to 2008 season. Grant walks up, and he's beside her before she realizes it. Huh, he says, staring up at the team photo. Helen turns to watch Grant studying the photo. It must be weird to see yourself become a part of the background scenery here, she says. I remember walking past these photos all the time and not really seeing them. And here you are. Weird, he echoes. Helen takes out her phone and snaps a photo of the framed picture. I'm sending this to the room, she says. Merry Christmas, one and all. Wait, no, that's not fair, Grant says, and grabs for her phone. Not unless there's one of you in the newspaper club dorks around here somewhere. Helen acts on instinct and hides the phone under her sweater, out of reach. They didn't appreciate our accomplishments as much as yours. You're lucky to be immortalized on the walls of our school. Grant laughs and seizes her by the shoulders from behind. Give it to me, he says, his voice a low growl in her ear. He has one arm looped across her chest, trapping her against his body. A strange thrill shoots up her back, and she feels him swallow hard. Oi! Grant releases her and she drops the phone with a clatter. A middle-aged man strides toward them from the far end of the hallway. His walkie-talkie beeps from his belt, and he points an accusing finger at them.
How did you get in? I'm talking to you.
Helen glances at Grant.
Run,
he says, and grabs her hand before sprinting for the closest door.
As it turns out, running wasn't the smartest idea. You tripped a silent alarm, Vice Principal Peters tells them in the parking lot where he's waiting with two security guards. What were you doing in there? Grant watches Helen transform into a helpless female before his eyes.
Oh my gosh, this is so embarrassing, she says. We graduated from here years ago, and we just wanted to come see the school.
By breaking and entering.
We didn't break anything,
Helen says, and looks at Grant with wide, innocent eyes.
Did we? The side door was unlocked.
Yeah, I remember we used to sneak in through that door when I was a senior, Grant says, pointing at the offending door. The locks were broken even back then. You guys should probably get that fixed.
We're not going to get in trouble, are we?
Helen turns back to the vice principal anxiously. She looks at him as if he has their fate in his hands, which Grant thinks is laying it on a little thick.
I swear we didn't take anything. We just wanted to see where we first fell in love. Right, babe?
She smacks Grant on the arm. He clears his throat. Yeah, such a romantic, this one. I told her we'd get in trouble, but... You're married, you get it. Grant nods at the ring on the vice principal's left hand. Are you two married? He asks, warming to them. Helen looks to Grant wildly.
No, I don't have a ring.
Grant pulls her to his side. Not yet, anyway. We keep arguing about how she wants me to propose. I'm still pitching football field at homecoming. Vice Principal Peters beams. Well, that'd be a hell of a story. Two Denoli alums getting engaged at homecoming. I bet you'd even make the front page of the Ampersand. Helen huffs and Grant grins at her.
You hear that? We'd make the Ampersand front page.
After exchanging email addresses with the vice principal, in case you do decide to do something at homecoming, and some thorough apologies for disturbing the peace on Christmas Eve, Grant and Helen walk silently back to the car in the north parking lot.
Don't laugh, she says. He's still watching.
What do you think the headline of our engagement story would be in the Ampersand? He asks as they approach the car. Helen rolls her eyes.
I'd never have let a story like that on the front page. Maybe a blurb on the sports page.
Ex-homecoming king finally finds his queen, Grant pitches, hopping into the driver's seat.
Ampersand standards plummeting, a former editor-in-chief reports, Helen responds.
Town daughter to wed her sister's slaughterer, Grant says. A stunned silence follows this as Helen turns to look at him. Grant freezes. Sorry, he says immediately. Sorry.
Then she bursts into laughter. Oh my God, she says, wiping tears from her eyes. You're going to hell.
And you're riding shotgun with me, Grant says as he throws the car in reverse.
The sun is setting by the time he drives her back to her car at the top of Washington Rock.
That was fun, she says.
It feels like giving something up when she says it. Some part of her flutters anxiously, as if to say, what if he doesn't agree? Yeah, he says, smiling at her in a way that does funny things to her stomach. What are you doing tomorrow?
Christmas?
Helping my mom clean the house, then cooking for all the Chinese aunties and uncles coming over for dinner. Sounds like a good Christmas, he says. If he were anyone else, she'd invite him over. You want to do something the day after? She asks instead. He nods. Sure. You pick the time and place. He's leaning against the car door, his arms folded across his chest as he watches her face. It occurs to her that there's something incredibly dear about him standing like this, and she's aware of a sudden gladness that he's here with her. A thought bubbles into her mind, and it grows insistent. Would you come with me to see my sister? He stills, and she thinks maybe she's made a mistake reading him.
It's too big an ask for so new and fragile a friendship. What are they to each other? He clears his throat, then nods. Sure, he says finally. If you want me there. She thinks about the day of Michelle's funeral. Of him showing up in a sweater and tie to the one room where his presence wasn't just unwanted, it was firmly rejected. She wonders if he's thinking about it now, too, as his brown eyes seek out hers. I do, she says. Okay, he says softly. I'll be there. 12. Christmas in their mostly agnostic Chinese household has become a familiar mishmash of traditions. Every year, Helen wakes up at 8 a.m. with the sun to the sound of porcelain plates and bowls moving downstairs. As she brushes her teeth and washes her face, the smell of this morning's tongue floats upstairs, some warming blend of bone broth, jujubes, and ginger. By the time she comes downstairs, her mother has set aside a quick breakfast for them to eat whenever they wake up. This year, it's steamed and salted taro root, already peeled and waiting in a thin plastic wrapper. Helen has never actually woken up early enough to see Mom eat on Christmas morning. She's already mopping the floors. Helen helps tidy up the living room and dusts the framed photos above the fireplace. Something always twists in her stomach when she reaches the single framed photo of her with Michelle. They're in middle school, at the peak of both their awkward phases and wearing bright neon snowsuits for a random ski trip they took with Mom and Dad's work friends. They look happy and nothing like themselves. Helen doesn't think they ever went skiing again. And those work friends eventually faded from their lives like so much background noise. They don't have stockings or wreaths or any decorations like that. She remembers going to another friend's house in December and being awed at the feeling of stepping into a Hallmark Christmas card. At their own house, Christmas is confined to a single room by the front door. They put up a fake tree they bought at Target 20 years ago and decorate with the same plastic ornaments every season. Still, there's a festive feeling in the air when she gets the red tablecloth out from the basement and helps Mom expand their dining room table to accommodate more guests. Her own contribution comes in the form of a mulled cider this year, which she brews in a crock pot according to the recipe that Tom from the writer's room emailed her. She puts on the Yule Log broadcast and listens to Christmas music over the new speaker system her parents bought last Black Friday. Dad vacuums all the carpets while Mom puts a roast duck in the oven. When Helen opens the fridge, it's full of frozen tiramisu from their nearby Costco. Sometime around 3 p.m., the first of her parents' friends arrive, holding dishes whose names Helen has never learned, but that have become familiar enough that she's made up her own for them. That black ear mushroom dish everyone likes, the flowery greens with the good dark sauce, the thin clear spaghetti with the stripy green vegetables and minced pork. Everyone greets her and gives her a hong bao, a red envelope stuffed with crisp new bills, at the door, and Mom nudges her to remind Helen to say thank you as if she's still 12 years old. It occurs to Helen that she's getting to an age where it's maybe embarrassing to still be accepting these cash envelopes. Surely her parents were in their early 30s when they started distributing them to their own friends as kids. Sometimes the other parents will bring their kids with them. Kids who are, at this point, full-grown adults like Helen. This year, it's Theo Jiao, in his third year of a post-residency fellowship at some teaching hospital. Helen tuned out when everyone started saying med school more than once in the conversation. Inevitably, there's the moment when the dinner conversation turns into a humble bragging competition between parents. Helen is so busy all the time with her TV show, she never calls anymore. Theo isn't sleeping enough. He's overworked at his cardiology fellowship. and then the not-so-subtle joking, ha-ha, not really, part of the evening, when they wonder why Helen and Theo don't just date each other and get married and have babies already. After dinner, Dad turns on the TV, and the grown-ups, Helen still thinks of them as grown-ups, all chatter idly while she and Theo watch Titanic.
That's cool they're making a TV show out of your books, Theo says.
I remember you were always reading at these things when we were kids. My mom donated your books to our local library.
Helen feels bad now for not paying more attention to Theo's residency talk. That's really nice of her, she says. My parents are proud of you, too. They sent me photos when you graduated med school. Helen wonders if Theo is actually single or if he's got a girlfriend waiting for him to call after this is all over. Theirs was always a friendship of convenience. Someone to talk to during these endless Chinese family gatherings. Someone who understood this world without needing explanations. It probably would be easier if they would just fall in love. And Helen remembers vaguely a period when they were teenagers, when she thought she might have a crush on him and practiced her flirting with him. It never came to anything, though. Maybe knowing their parents wanted it so badly sapped it of any real potential. Theo checks his phone, and Helen takes that as a sign that it wouldn't be rude to check hers as well. There's a string of Merry Christmas texts from her YA author group chat and from the Ivy Papers writer's room, which is currently litigating an ugly sweater-off happening at Owen's family Christmas. She sends a festive emoji to the group chat and votes for Owen's uncle. Her phone dings, and it's a text from Grant, to her individually. On for tomorrow? Merry Christmas, BTW.
Grant remembers when Christmas at their house was a not-to-be-missed event of the season. His mom would deck the halls and hire landscapers to string up a spectacular lighting display that made him proud to claim the house at the top of the hill as his home. She'd make him put on a suit for Christmas Day church services, and then they'd host all the extended family for a catered Christmas dinner. They kept it up for the first year he was back from college, but by the second year, his parents were separated, and his mom said it was too much bother to manage on her own. Instead, they went to one of her book club friends' Christmas parties. In the last few years, she hasn't wanted to venture out. The roads are icy and it's so much work for a boring party. Grant still spends Christmas dinner at home, but it's a simple meal for two now. This year, though, his mom seems more in the holiday spirit. She hums as she prepares the Christmas roast and offers him wine. "It's our last Christmas in this house," she says cheerfully. Fa-la-la-la-la. It occurs to Grant that this may also be one of his last trips to Denali, if the house sells as quickly as the agent promises it will. "Mark anything you don't want tossed," his mom had told him when he first arrived, "and I'll ship it to you when the time comes." Grant doesn't have room for all the souvenirs of his childhood in his house, nor does he particularly want them. But he caught his mom crying over one of his Pop Warner football trophies the other day. "We were so proud of you." And he knows she'd balk at the thought of throwing everything out to the curb with this year's Christmas tree. She'd probably hang on to all of it in a storage facility somewhere, spending unnecessary money preserving insignificant memories. So he puts post-its on things at random. His old yearbooks, a few books, a random football. It'll be easier to throw them out once he has full ownership over them. His phone dings with a message, and he violates the old rule of no cell phones at the dinner table because Lisa Shepherd is currently dancing in the kitchen to Bobby Vinton. It's from Helen. "Is 4 p.m. too late? Have to help clean up in the morning." He gives the message a thumbs up, and her next message is a dropped pin for Somerset Grove Cemetery, followed by, "Meet you in the parking lot at the bottom of the hill." A thumbs up feels almost too whimsical for the conversation now, and he thinks for a moment on an appropriate response before he types back, "Thanks for inviting me." 13. Grant buys flowers from the supermarket at the last minute because he isn't sure what the right thing to do is, but he'd rather err on the side of bringing something. The checkout lady smiles indulgently at him when he places the flowers on the conveyor, and he feels uncomfortable at the thought that she's misinterpreting the gesture. He pulls past the wrought iron gates of the cemetery and sees the parking lot is pretty full. It makes sense, he supposes, that a lot of people would want to visit their loved ones during the holidays. Helen waits outside her car in a woolen winter coat, and he feels bad that she's been standing in the cold waiting for him. Sorry, he says, and holds up the flowers. I wasn't sure whether I should bring something. No, that's really nice, Helen says. It's up this way. She leads them up the gravel path, past the oldest headstones covered in lichen and the craggy trees that must create a more picturesque scene in the spring and summer, but currently give the place a haunted winter feeling. The snow from a few days ago has melted by now, and the dirt beneath their feet is still wet and dark with moisture. Helen wears heeled boots, and he catches a glimpse of dark sheer tights under the swishing skirt of her long camel coat. They reach the top of the hill, and Helen slows her pace so they're walking side by side, their elbows occasionally brushing as they navigate the bumpy path. How was your Christmas? She asks. Good, he says. Then thinks about it, really. Fine. Underwhelming. Just dinner at home. But I didn't mind. I always get my fill of Christmas spirit in L.A. before flying back. She nods.
Christmas in L.A. seems like it'd be so different, she says. No snow.
There's no snow here this year either.
Yeah, but there's a chance of it, and that makes a difference, I think.
There's fake snow at the Grove, he says, referencing an upscale outdoor mall in mid-city. They run it every hour or so with soap suds.
That's not the same, though.
No, but it's fun anyway. Helen smiles, then slows her walk. She points directly below them at the nearest row of headstones.
She's over here.
Grant's heart beats a little faster, and his body tenses. Helen looks up at him with eyes that always seem to see too much.
Come on,
she says softly, and slips her hand in his as she leads the way forward. They stop in front of a dark marble headstone. Michelle Zhang, May 24th, 1992, to June 7th, 2008. Beloved daughter, sister, friend.
Helen watches as Grant crouches down and places the supermarket flowers across the bottom of the headstone. The flowers are wrapped in festive cellophane, and it feels almost as if he's saying, Merry Xmas, Merry Xmas, Merry Xmas, to her dead sister. She sits down on the grass in front of the headstone, and he sits beside her. Why did you come to the church that day? She asks. He hesitates, and she becomes aware that they're holding hands still. He studies their gloved hands as he contemplates an answer. I felt like I should, he says. I didn't really want to. I just felt like I owed it to her or something. It was stupid in retrospect. I was thinking about me and not how it'd make your family feel. My dad tried to talk me out of it, to be fair. It must have been hard for you, she says. He laughs mirthlessly. Hard for me, he murmurs. You lost your sister. Helen turns back to look at the headstone as he gives her hand a slight squeeze. My parents asked for my input on the inscription. I gave them the blandest, most generic one on purpose. She studies the headstone for what feels like a long time before she looks at him. You know, if someone in your family dies by suicide, your chances of being suicidal increase. Grant turns to look at her sharply. Helen exhales. One of the school counselors told me that. I spent the rest of that summer paranoid every time I picked up a knife or scissors, which was stupid, honestly, because after all this time, I still don't understand how she could do it. They stare out at the same view, as if an answer might materialize before them. After she died, I became so angry at suicide prevention organizations. I know that sounds strange, Helen says. Everywhere I looked, it seemed like there were messages to reach out if you were worried about someone, to tell them you loved them, to tell them they weren't a burden, to help them find help. It infuriated me. The idea that they all seemed to believe there was something I could have done to keep Michelle from killing herself. Helen picks at the grass with her free hand, then presses her palm into the dirt. It's the life and death stakes. Everyone wants to believe they could save someone else's life if they saw the right signs, had the right tools. Like maybe if I say the right words in the right combination this time, she'll choose life. But that's not how it happens. She laughs, a short, brittle one. What happens is your sister withdraws and becomes distant, but not all the time. And you think, she's just being a teenager. And then you find out she's doing things you'd never dream of doing. She had a boyfriend and a drug dealer before I even had my first kiss. But you want to be cool about it. You don't want to seem like you're overreacting, and you don't want to get her into trouble, and she's a fucking asshole to you back. And you start checking in and checking in, and she pushes you away and pushes you away, and finally you're like, fine, and fuck you too. And then suddenly she's dead. The letters on the headstone are still sharp and easy to read, and Helen has to look away. I refused to feel guilty after she died, she says to the ground. And no one knew how to talk to me. Everyone knows how to say, it wasn't your fault. But if you say, I know it wasn't my fault, it was hers, people get uncomfortable. And maybe they're right. Maybe it wasn't Michelle at the steering wheel of her own body that night. She died without ever having gone to a therapist, so I have no idea what disorders might have been driving her. She was probably an addict. She didn't look like one, like how I pictured addicts before. Desperate, homeless strangers on the street. She lived in our house. She was smart and she had people who loved her, and it still wasn't enough. Helen swipes away a frustrated tear. I called a suicide hotline the Monday after she died. I didn't want to kill myself, she says. I just wanted to talk to someone who was used to talking to people who did. I remember asking him, do you think if everyone on Earth went through the training you did, learned how to talk about suicide without all the stigma and the self-consciousness, do you think then we'd live in a world where no one would ever kill themselves again? I wanted to see if there was a way to cure it, like cancer. And I'll never forget. The man on the other end of the line said, no. I can almost guarantee you, some of them still would. And I hung up after that. Helen draws a shaky breath. I took her suicide really personally. She laughs, and it comes out a stifled, wet sound. It felt like she took all the love I had to give and said, nope. It's not good enough, which is probably not the healthiest way of looking at it, but I am so sick of always being the healthy one. Her breath comes out in shaky spurts now, and Helen becomes aware of the warmth of Grant's body, his left side pressing against her right as she commands herself, do not cry. Grant shifts his arm slightly, not enough that it's wrapped around her, but enough that she feels the support of it against her back. Did you know her at all? She asks thickly. No, Grant says, his voice hoarse. It feels like a long time since she last heard it. She might have been friendly with some people I knew, but I didn't really pay close attention to things like that back then. She was loud and bright and unpredictable, Helen says, thinking of squawking arguments and long car rides and sudden unexpected displays of sisterly affection. It was like Michelle felt all her emotions, good and bad, at a higher saturation than anyone else in our family. She could be really funny, too. We'd get into fights. You borrowed my sweater, you were a bitch about something when I was really upset, sister shit. And she'd come up with these incredible, really mean one-liners. Just in the moment, that were so funny, I'd have a hard time staying angry because I wanted to laugh so hard. She probably could have become a comedian if she'd wanted. But I have no idea what she actually would have wanted.
Was there a note? Grant asks, his voice quiet.
Not a physical one, Helen says, and feels strangely grateful for the chance to tell him. But I always thought if she'd tried to write one, she would have done it on her laptop. She was so obsessed with that thing when she got it. I have her hard drive all backed up, and I've looked, but I've never found anything. I'm sorry, Grant murmurs, and she wonders what he's apologizing for. We buried her in the Chinese community section of the cemetery, so she's spending eternity with all the old grandmas and grandpas and Saturday morning Chinese school principals who never approved of her. If ghosts exist, she's probably giving them hell.
Do you think you'll be buried here? He asks.
It's a blunt, existential question, one she's thought of before. No, she says. I always liked the idea of having my ashes scattered in some significant place. The problem is I've never really felt that strongly about anywhere. I like a lot of places, but enough for eternity? Then again, it probably wouldn't matter. I'm overthinking it, I know.
I read somewhere that you can get your remains turned into organic mush and they'll plant a tree over your body, Grant says.
It feels macabre to be talking about bodies turning into mush when he feels so warm and solid and alive against her. She drops her head against his waiting shoulder.
What kind of tree would you be? Helen asks. I don't know, he says, and she feels the deep rumble of his voice against her body. I guess I feel the way you feel about places with trees.
Helen lifts her head slightly and studies Grant Shepherd from closer up than she ever has before.
I feel like you'd be an oak tree. It's like the golden retriever of trees.
Grant laughs, a genuine laugh this time. The sound is jarring in the cemetery. Helen looks out at the view and tries to see a peaceful park instead of a final resting place. I haven't been back here without my parents since the week we buried her, she says. I was really mad at her for a long time, and it's kind of depressing here.
Thanks for bringing me, he says, and smoothly presses a kiss against the side of her brow.
They're both quiet then, and for a moment she listens to their synchronized breaths, inhaling and exhaling with the wind.
It's not a big deal, she says finally and looks away.
We should get going, though, before it gets dark.
He offers her a hand up, and she takes it.
Are you hungry? He asks.
A little, she says, even though she isn't.
The path is rocky, and he touches her elbow lightly as she climbs back up the hill.
You should come over for dinner, he says. There's always too much food anyway.
Would that be okay? She lifts her brows.
Yeah, he says. Come over.